Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial will be unveiled to the public, the formal dedication this Sunday. And this hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the memorial. We will analyze the incredible work of Dr. King. We will hear what I think is one of his most moving speeches, because it was delivered. It's a very long speech, but we'll hear part of the speech that he delivered the day before he died in Memphis, Tennessee, to sanitation workers. We have two guests with us this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls about this movement that Dr. King championed. The vision statement of the Washington, D.C. National Memorial says that it's a movement that draws fully from the deep well of America's potential for freedom, opportunity, and justice. His vision of America is captured in his message of hope and possibility for a future anchored in dignity, sensitivity, and mutual respect, a message that challenges each of us to recognize that America's true strength lies in its diversity of talents. Congresswoman Gwen Moore joining us at the top of the show, Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District. She, of course, has done a lot of work in the state of Wisconsin. She served in the Wisconsin State Senate from 93 to 2004, and also two consecutive terms in the Wisconsin State Assembly from 1989 to 1992. I always love saying this because actually, I wasn't aware of her award. She was a VISTA volunteer many years ago, a community leader here in Milwaukee, and she earned the National VISTA Volunteer of the Decade Award from 1976 to 1986. Also joining us, Professor Michael Honey, Professor of Labor and Ethnic Studies and American History at the University of Washington, Tacoma. One of his special areas is Dr. Martin Luther King. He's the author of a number of books, including All Labor Has Dignity, Martin Luther King's Speeches for Labor Rights and Economic Justice. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, great. Thanks for asking me to come on, Kathleen.
Oh,
thank you so much.
You were the person I thought of because I knew you would be moved by this whole weekend celebration. Have you had a chance to have a sneak preview of the memorial?
I did have the privilege to have a sneak preview of it, and it was really, really awesome. There were some criticisms with respect to the artist being an Asian, but I think he got it. I think he did a very good job, and you know, above and beyond it's very, very detailed, but it's this vision of the Stone of Hope, I'm not sure of the exact name, sort of coming out of the mountain of despair. It is really a powerful symbol of the American dream and the American struggle toward equality for all. I mean, we are a country that's made up of immigrants from everywhere. And this is a perfect symbol for all Americans.
And the remarkable thing, we just went to Washington some months ago, but to look at those memorials, you realize that they are there for the ages. He is there forever.
Absolutely. And to have him dignify the mall, this is quite the coup d'etat because, you know, land is of a premium there in Washington, D.C. So to have this memorial to Martin Luther King Jr. For everyone in the world to see is a tribute to this country's amazing struggle. When you think about all of the so-called Arab Spring movements and other movements that have occurred, they have been inspired by the movement that this real humble minister really was at the pinnacle of.
The speeches, parts of other speeches, I understand, are dispersed in stone along various parts of the memorial. Are there certain quotes of his that kind of guide the work that you do? Are there certain speeches that you find, in addition to the dream speech that we all remember, other speeches that we ought to really pay attention to?
You know, one of the speeches that that really moves me, and I can't swear to you that it's memorialized on these walls, but as an elected official, one of the speeches that Martin Luther King gives calls upon men and women to put people in office that will do justice. You know, this profession has been so reviled by people, but it is an honorable profession. It's a profession where if you march on ballot boxes, you know, as he wants people to do in this particular speech, march on these ballot boxes and put men and women in there who will do justice. And that really resonates with me. That's the only reason that I am elected. You know, I'm not elected for the title or for the prestige of being elected. I am there because there are so many, of my neighbors, my friends, even people in my family who have no voice. They're the voiceless. And, you know, without people who are there on a daily, regular basis, trying to make sure that there's equal protection for women's rights and for children's rights and workers' rights and, just the average Joe that doesn't want any more than just to put a Tonka truck or a Barbie doll under the Christmas tree or, you know, that's their whole goal in life, to be able to have barbecue on the 4th of July, to give people that basic dignity. To be able to go to the doctor, you know, if when you see something is wrong, and I think that this is really the American dream. It's not as it's not as flamboyant as some of the detractors might want to make. I mean, people want a basic standard of living that they can rely on, and that's what motivates me in my daily work.
Yeah. I was looking at some of the pictures of some of the marches in one of Taylor Branch's books last night, and it was so striking to me. Well, first, it was such a dangerous thing to do, to march for the right to vote. Pictures of 104-year-old gentlemen who had never voted before, that you had a country where people had not been able to vote for 100 years.
Absolutely. You know, and I tell you that the American dream is just the American Constitution and its laws is riddled with the demand that we protect people's rights to vote. I mean, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, of course, was to guarantee that slaves would be able to vote. And then the 19th Amendment, so that women would be able to vote. And the 23rd Amendment, so that D.C. residents could vote. And so on and so forth. The 24th Amendment, that there could be no more of these literacy tests and poll taxes. The 26th Amendment, so that 18-year-olds could vote. And the Voting Rights Act, which has been reauthorized in 73 and in 82 and just recently here in 2006, to make sure that some of these southern states in particular that have tried to put up blocks against African Americans' ability to vote would have to pre-clear their decisions with the Justice Department. And I guess, you know, when we talk about the mountain of despair that is accruing here in this country, it is very chilling to see us right here in this state, Kathleen, fighting these same battles we thought we had won. You know, this onerous voter ID requirement that has just been enacted by the state legislature and signed into law by Governor Scott Walker, it is the most stringent voting rights law in the country ever, and it is reminiscent of the struggles that Dr. Martin Luther King led against years and years ago, and it's very frightening. And it's not just that. Your other speaker probably is going to be more of an expert on the labor laws, but Martin Luther King, when he was walking with those garbage workers, those sanitation workers in Memphis, the day he was shot, he spoke out against these so-called right-to-work laws. He said, quote, "In our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right-to-work. It is a law to rob us of civil rights and jobs rights. Its purpose, to destroy labor unions and freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone." I mean, back in 1961, that was a speech he gave in 1961. I'm sorry, not on the eve of his assassination, but that long ago. I mean, that is literally 40, what is it, 40, 71, 81, 91, yeah, 40
right.
years ago. 2001, 50 years ago, he gave that speech against the so-called right-to-work laws and destroying collective bargaining. And where are we here in our own state of Wisconsin? Right back at square one, where we have seen collective bargaining rights stripped in the name of balancing our budget. They have stripped people of their ability to determine working conditions at the job place. So it is... you know, on one level, it's we're back at the mountain of despair. But this memorial, where his image is carved out as a stone of hope, I think that it really gives impetus to not just me, someone who was alive and I remember. I lived during the era of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but to give this Joshua generation, this next generation of young people who might have the privilege to see that, some sort of guide stone and touchstone for pressing on for the future. That's the only hope I have, Kathleen, is to know that I was young and I was impressed by Dr. Martin Luther King. I dedicated my life to freedom and justice because of his example. And now that I'm 60 years old, I'm trying to teach these things to younger people as well. Yeah. This symbol means a lot.
Yeah, it sure does. It means a whole lot. Symbols are important. The voter ID bill is being legally challenged. Do you think it has a chance to be changed, to be overturned in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I think that the people who have, we have seen the willingness of people who want to deny, you know, the elderly, students, African Americans and Latinos, people of color in particular, who would have the disparate disadvantage under this. We have seen them being willing to spend millions of dollars for their position. And so I say that it's unfortunate that justice can be paid for. And so I think that it's really going to take a lot of lawsuits and a lot of money and a lot of time, you know, to really make sure that the injured by these new laws have a voice in their day in court. I don't think that the solution to this will be short term, but I do know that there are people in this for the long haul.
Congresswoman Gwen Moore has time for a couple phone calls. We're talking about the Martin Luther King Jr. National Memorial. She's already had a chance to see it and is moved by it. It will be dedicated on Washington, D.C.'s National Mall this Sunday. It's the 48th anniversary of King's I Have a Dream speech. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take a call for, I know you're in a hurry, so we'll do you have time for
no,
a call?
I'm good. I'm
you're good.
Good?
All right, you're good. All right, Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. With all due respect to your guest, I really think that her comment that the loss of collective bargaining, this Wisconsin thing, is we're back with the amount of despair is kind of hogwash. I think that if Martin Luther King was around today, he would look at a gentleman like Herman Cain, who probably odds on is going to be vice president, if not president nominee for the Republican Party, an outstanding black American from humble beginnings, that he would begin to see all the outstanding black Americans who've accomplished so much as a result of Martin Luther King, and would disagree with her firmly that there's a mountain of despair that exists for black Americans or minorities or anybody else. That's just simply hogwash.
There is
okay,
this.
Well, you know, I, you know, the minute people say with all due respect, I brace myself to be insulted. But just let me say this. I'm a person like Herman Cain who's benefited from Dr. Martin Luther King, trying to bring justice and freedom and equality for everyone. As an African-American, I can tell you that people like Herman Cain, like me, we have benefited so much by, number one, labor rights organizations. To the extent that there is a black middle class, it's been because we have had labor unions that have insisted, have negotiated decent wages for people. When you look at the Postal Service, for example, which was the number one place where African Americans started to be able to get an opportunity and move into the middle class. You know, they were represented by a union. And I would even go so far to say, without knowing in particular, that Herman Cain has benefited from affirmative action laws, from a long history of litigation in this country, an American soul urge toward providing opportunities for small businesses, for minority businesses. And I can't speak for Dr. Martin Luther King as to, you know, whether or not he'd say what I was saying was hogwash or not. I know that I am a product of the opportunities that he and Lyndon Baines Johnson and others wanted to provide by having decent schooling opportunities. I've benefited tremendously from civil rights legislation that prevented, that provided equal access to educational opportunity and barred racial segregation in schooling, that provided a right to vote, and also, yes, provided me with a middle class standard of living because of collective bargaining rights. I haven't always been a congresswoman. I have worked for the city. I've worked for the state. I've worked for public and private organizations. I've worked in the private sector, and even when I worked in the private sector, I was represented by labor organizations that negotiated for decent wages, for time off, for sick pay, and other sort of intangibles that create a better life for people. But I do thank you for your call.
And with all due respect, Andy, I must say that one of the issues that we've been dealing with, and you're hearing more about it, perhaps not enough, that would appall Dr. King and probably appalls you, is the stories we're hearing about this staggering racial wealth gap in this country. It is enormous.
Well, Andy's no longer there, Kathleen.
No, that... I know, he's gone. Yeah, okay. Let's go. Our number is 800-486-8655. Congresswoman Gwen Moore is our guest, and it is the Martin Luther King Memorial that we are talking about. It's going to be dedicated this Sunday. The final thing I want to talk to you about is the other sense that you get from all of this is power on a human scale. The number of people, average citizens, who bonded together to make things better, to fight for human rights. It really was very much a ordinary people, wasn't it, in many ways?
It really was. And I'll tell you, you know, the civil rights movement, I think, changed the quality of my life and what it would have been. Growing up here in Wisconsin, obviously, I grew up in a state where there was a very low African-American population. And I have friends from every race, every color. I mean, people who, you know, that I didn't just see occasionally, but were my buddies, my friends, that I hung out with. And the bond that I had with people that have been my friends for 40 and 50 years has been that we've worked around opposing the Vietnam War. We have marched for equality and educational opportunity, against segregation in the Milwaukee public school system, that we have bonded around environmental justice. We have bonded around rights for gays and lesbians. We have bonded around human rights issues. And so, Dr. Martin Luther King was not only a role model and icon for African Americans, but for all people. And I think that that's why he has won a spot on the mall. And even to have an Asian artist render him is a tribute to the universality of this man.
Yes.
Universality of Dr. King.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Congresswoman Gwen Moore, Democratic U.S. Representative. She is in representing Milwaukee, downtown area, Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District. We're going to continue our conversation about Dr. Martin Luther King. And joining us in just a few moments will be Michael Honey. He's a professor in humanities, professor of labor and ethnic studies and American history at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and author of a number of books, including books analyzing Dr. King's speeches. Before we meet him, I wanted to play some of his speeches. We, most of us know the I Have a Dream speech, and of course it's the, which is hard to believe, 48th anniversary of that speech this Sunday. This is a speech that is really quite lengthy. I recommend that you listen to all of it because he talks about the arc of history in this long address that was delivered to sanitation workers and those supporting Memphis sanitation workers. This was the day before he was assassinated in Memphis, and it gives a sense of what a human being is able to accomplish. Some of you will be familiar with this. Some of you maybe have never heard this story, but it's the "If I Had Sneezed."
And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." And the next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a 9th grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, I I want to say tonight that I, too, am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. And the black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me.
Dr. Martin Luther King. August 3rd, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee, the day before he was assassinated. Today we're talking about the memorial that will be unveiled this Sunday, 48 years after the I Have a Dream speech. The official memorial unveiling will be this Sunday, and we thought an appropriate time to talk about all that's happened before this memorial will be unveiled, and it's a lot. Professor Michael Honey is joining us now. He is a professor of labor and ethnic studies and American history at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He combines scholarship with civic engagement, teaches African-American civil rights and labor history, and specializes in work on Martin Luther King. He has written a number of books. He won the History Book Club Award for Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. And he's written a number of other books and has studied very deeply Dr. Martin Luther King's labor and economic speeches. He was a Southern civil rights and civil liberties organizer from 1970 to 1976. He links scholarship, music, and public speaking with community and labor organizing. Professor Michael Honey, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, that speech always just makes me, it just takes me to another place every time I hear it, and knowing when he gave it, and the whole arc of history that now he is in a very prominent way forever a part of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one thing to read a King speech, but to hear him give it is a different experience.
Yeah, it is. Will you go to the memorial unveiling?
No, I'm not going to be there. A lot of people I know will be there, and I hope tens or hundreds of thousands of others on Sunday, I guess.
You have done a great deal of writing about his speeches, his economic speeches, his justice speeches. Are there certain speeches that you want us to pay particular attention to as we approach this unveiling? Are there words of his that have not been as prominently analyzed and thought about as they should have been?
Yeah, there's a lot of material on King. As you know, he's been one of the more studied people in our history, and there are a lot of speeches that he gave that are extremely important, but almost unknown. I've just published a book of those speeches. It's called All Labor Has Dignity. and there are speeches that he gave to unions from right after the Montgomery bus boycott, starting in 1957, up until that speech you just played, which was given in Memphis, Tennessee on April 3rd, to a meeting of people who were mostly strikers in the Memphis sanitation strike. That was a meeting where it was part of a series of mass meetings in Memphis in a strike movement that went on for about 6 weeks. And there are many occasions where he was involved, such as that, in community struggles. And the reason people brought him in was he had all these connections with people across the country, and also he had this incredible power to inspire. And so those two things, his movement that he was part of and his power to encapsulate the moment was extraordinary. But also the content of what he said was also very powerful. And in the speech you just played, which is in this book, All Labor Has Dignity, he talks about the sanitation workers and that the important thing for people in the middle class and clergy and teachers and so forth is to recognize the struggles of the poor and the working poor. And in that speech, he's trying to draw their attention to what he calls going down Jericho Road, doing like the Good Samaritan and stopping and helping someone who's in danger or who's in need. But even if at the expense of your own safety, which he did in right. Memphis, and it was a sort of basic principle with him, was that putting yourself out for a good cause, even if it means dying in that cause. But it has a special resonance for our times because of what's happened to Wisconsin and Ohio and other places where they're trying to roll back public employee rights. And we need to rally people who are maybe not in that situation, who maybe are better off or who are not in unions. But all of us need to support the rights of working people and poor people. And that's what King was spending a lot of his time doing in the last year of his life.
Isn't it rather jarring that we have this official unveiling of a statue that will live forever, a very big thing in Washington, D.C.? There aren't very many of those statues, and none that honor an African-American man that fought as he did for so much. In the midst of one of the largest wealth gaps in this country, in the midst of, as you point out, a staggering racial wealth gap, and in the midst of, I don't see a whole lot of concern for the poor and working people. It just seems to have passed by the wayside.
Well, it's ironic that people who claim to be so upset about the problems with the country, the people on the right who claim to be so upset, say nothing about poverty. And it's one of the biggest growing problems in our country and all the things that go with poverty, families falling apart, crime, neighborhood decay, cutting our essential services because taxes are down. We're really in a crisis of the poor and the working poor, but it's rarely explained that way except by labor people.
Remind us, please, of his Poor People's Campaign. And I know that it was an issue. There was some disagreement among his top staff as to what he should champion. He really believed that he needed to highlight poverty.
Yeah. King said, and you'll find it in this book of speeches, All Labor Has Dignity, he tells the Teamsters Union in 1967 in a speech in New York City that the movement should be understood as being in two phases. And the first phase was to obtain civil and voting rights, which he said without obtaining civil rights and the right to vote, African-Americans can't have any influence and can't change anything. society, but with the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, he said we're now bringing that first phase to a close. But the second phase is what he called the struggle for economic equality. And he didn't mean that everybody would make the same wage or that we'd all be the same, but what he meant was that everybody would have an equal chance. And in his Poor People's Campaign, he was pinpointing the reality, which is that millions of people have been just discarded by the industrial economy at that time. A lot of people in Mississippi and the Deep South who no longer had jobs in the cotton economy and couldn't get jobs in the industrial economy. And in our time, you know, 40 years since King, a lot of the manufacturing jobs are now gone as well. So his Poor People's Campaign was an attempt to get the country to change its priorities dramatically. And we're in that same situation now, that our priorities are all wrong. And if we're concerned about the conditions of our fellow citizens.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. Joy in West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Yes, I heard about this new memorial, and I hadn't heard about it coming on, so I was really pleased to know that there's a memorial for Dr. Martin Luther King. When I was a young person, I was born in 1950, so I heard Dr. King's speeches on television. I remember thinking, they're over my head. He used big words, metaphors, and biblical references, and they were difficult for me to understand, but as I grew older and understood them more, I could tell that his speeches were immensely inspiring to people and to me. It helped us, like somebody like Gwen Moore, also reach for knowledge and vision and wisdom and try to go out working on what Dr. King was working on. So I also want to say I'm proud of our Congresswoman Gwen Moore for continuing to work under difficult conditions. She continues to work as one of those people that Dr. King called on to step forward and represent people under difficult conditions.
Thank you very much for the call. Well, what do you think Representative Moore was talking about, what it means for future generations? She lived through the King years. I did too. You did too. What does it mean for people who, and there will be hundreds of thousands, millions of people who will go to that memorial who were not alive during the time that he walked this earth? What does a memorial mean to those people?
I think they've tried to set up the memorial in such a way that you're not just looking at the statue of a man, but you're reading about what he had to say, and there are quotes on walls all around. And it's much like going to the Franklin Roosevelt Memorial, which is close by, that hopefully you'll be thinking about some of the main issues that he was pointing to, as well as the overarching issue of human rights and equality. What does that consist of? And so I think it'll be a really great exhibit that goes with the memorial. So I hope a lot of people will be thinking about, well, what does this mean for us today? I think that's the intent of the whole project, is, you know, to carry the legacy of the civil rights movement and the other movements that he was associated with into the present. And remember, he was very involved with the anti-war movement of his time. And with this new book, All Labor Has Dignity, it shows very clearly he was also very involved with the labor movement, not just in Memphis, but all through his life, through his adult life. So I think that the memorial is not the memorial to a man so much as the memorial to our collective efforts to address human rights in the economy and in war and peace and in race and other forms of inequality.
Professor Michael Honey is our guest. This part of the show, 2011 John Simon Guggenheim Fellow in the Humanities, Professor of Labor and Ethnic Studies and American History at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and author of a number of books, including All Labor Has Dignity, Martin Luther King's Speeches for Labor Rights and Economic Justice. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on behalf of a civil rights movement which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not yet won the very peace and brotherhood which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award which I receive on behalf of that movement is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression.
Dr. Martin Luther King accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. We should also pay heed to the fact that he was an adherent of nonviolence. The nonviolent part of this whole movement is quite striking, I think, Professor.
Well, in my previous book, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign, James Lawson, who was the ministerial leader of that strike in Memphis, explains that someone like Dr. King or himself, who was an adherent to nonviolence, has a philosophy that encompasses all the issues, basically. Poverty is a form of violence, as well as war being a form of violence. And hate is a form of violence to the soul. And King had this all-encompassing view that allowed him to take in issues as they developed. I'm sure if he were alive today, he would be supporting the rights of transgendered and gay people. He would be supporting human rights in Egypt and other parts of the world. He was flexible, and his framework was this basic one of human rights, equality, and justice within the context of nonviolence, which means do no harm and do good. And that was his whole way of operating. I think we could learn a lot from that today. If we would apply that philosophy to the issues that we're facing, I don't think we would have so much trouble figuring out what it is we should be doing.
Spencer in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I was calling up today to ask you and your guests there whether or not there's indeed still more work to be done, especially in view of such things as the transcendent view of race. You have comments like Chris Matthews, who was made where, upon the election of Obama, he said, "I forgot he was black for an hour." And whether or not that the racism has just become much more subtle than this at this point in day and age.
I don't think racism is really very subtle. It's a question of how you understand racism. I know where I live in Tacoma, in the public school system, there's a huge difference between young African-American students progress through the public schools and white students. And that's a lot of it's socioeconomic, but it's also attached to race. And our whole history around race is that way. So, you know, also the fact that there's been this incredible opposition, sort of gut-level opposition to President Obama from the beginning tells me that race is still very much in the equation of what we're struggling with today. But we've made huge progress, and this is what King called phase one. We've got voting rights and civil rights effectively functioning in this country for all people. Maybe not for recent immigrants. That's where it's not functioning. But I think racism as a socioeconomic problem, institutional racism, economic racism especially, is still very much there.
And thanks for the call. Tell me about the work that you did. You were a Southern civil rights and civil liberties organizer in the 70s. What did you do, Professor?
I was working in, you know, a lot of people think the movement died after Dr. King was killed, which isn't true at all. It was accelerating through the 70s. And there were, it was during the Nixon administration when I was doing my work in the South. And the Nixon administration was trying to shut down all our freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, basic civil liberties. And so I worked for the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. I was the Southern director, and I traveled all over the South trying to rally people to stop the Nixon-era criminal code reform and a whole series of laws they were proposing. If we hadn't had the Watergate blow-up, I think, which exposed the illegal, unconstitutional activities of that government, I'm not sure where that would have gone. Nixon was forced to resign because of that, but up until that point, they were busily shutting down all our civil liberties and civil rights.
And when you look at the issues that are with us now, if you were to leave your work as a professor and do community organizing again, what needs most attention now?
The labor movement. I would, if I were to focus on one thing now, I would be organizing around jobs and economic justice and all the other issues about racism and sexism and violence against immigrants. To me, these things all today, it's almost like the labor movement now is the human rights movement of our times, and it encompasses so many other issues. And that's what I'd be working on.
Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. Glad to talk to you. I grew up in Federal Way, Washington, and unfortunately for you, I guess I got my undergraduate degrees at Washington State University, your bitter rivals across
yeah.
state. Uh-huh. One of the things, though, is when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, there was a, I guess you could call it a pantheon of saints. There was St. Jefferson and St. Lincoln and St. Washington and Jackson, and modern historians have pretty much decanonized them to the point where, you know, we now understand a lot more about these people as the human beings, as the flawed human beings they were, and the complexities of them. What I find disturbing is that it seems like we're canonizing somebody else now, Dr. Martin Luther King. And as I recall, he was like a very controversial period, a person during the time.
Mm-hmm.
He made trips to the Soviet Union, which made a lot of people think he was a communist. In fact,
he was a complex man. We're running out of time. I just want you to briefly comment on that. We tend to not give very full pictures of people. It doesn't diminish his greatness in any way, but there was a lot to this man.
Well, I think if we understand the controversies, it'll be very good for us in terms of knowing what the issues are. I hope we're not making him into some kind of a saint, because he would be the last one to think that was a good idea. He always said the Martin Luther King didn't make the movement. The movement made Martin Luther King. So he was really a man of his times, but I think that the overarching issues of equal rights, human equality, economic justice, peace, civil and political rights for all people, those are the reasons that he's being memorialized in this way, because we want this to be part of our civic culture. We want people to study about these things and learn about these things. And he was controversial. He opposed the war. The FBI was trying to destroy him as a leader. And he not only opposed the war, but he stood up for union rights in Memphis and went down fighting for that.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Michael Honey, from the University of Washington, Tacoma. And this Sunday, the dedication of the memorial of Dr. Martin Luther King. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings.